On this episode of Death Row Stories, young newlyweds are brutally murdered.
Herbert Whitlock and Randy Steibel are charged with murder. The two had been suspects all along.
They were clearly capable of committing murder.
But with a man sentenced to death.
I've done some bad things in my life, but I've never done anything like this.
And his own family doubting his innocence.
The Illinois State Police were involved. He's got to be guilty.
One cop fights to reopen the case.
You ask, how is a murder too politically sensitive? Why can't you speak out about corruption? This case stinks.
There's a body in the water.
He was butchered and murdered.
Many people proclaim their innocence.
In this case, there are a number of things that stink.
This man is remorseless.
He needs to pay for it with his life.
The electric chair flashed in front of my eyes.
Get a conviction at all costs. Let the truth fall where it may.
The tiny town of Paris, Illinois, is located 200 miles south of Chicago. Neighbors in Paris know one another and sleep with their doors unlocked.
Three words to describe Paris: conservative, agricultural, and small.
On a midsummer's night in 1986, the easy calm of Paris was shattered by a fire at the home of Dyke and Karen Rhodes. Inside, firemen discovered the lifeless bodies of the newlywed couple. But they soon realized the Rhodes had been killed by something other than smoke and flames.
Dyke and Karen Rhodes had been stabbed numerous times. What they had on their hands was a murder that had attempted to be concealed by arson.
Yesterday, authorities were suspicious. Today, they are certain. 28-year-old Dyke Rhodes and his 25-year-old wife, Karen, were murdered. Edgar County State's Attorney Michael McFetridge says they are dealing with more than just a fire.
This was a horrific crime. It seemed to be a crime of great anger and great passion.
Why Dyke and Karen Rhodes? They're both very clean cut. They both had jobs. There was talk in town that Dyke was a bit of a partier, but he wasn't involved in any really bad stuff.
With no clear motive, police struggled throughout the summer to come up with any leads or suspects.
There really was no break in this case at all for about 2.5 months. But in September, the town drunk, Daryl Harrington, was at the police station. He blurts out, "Just don't ask me about the murders." And of course, they ask him about the murders.
Daryl Harrington told police that on the night of the murders, he'd been out drinking with two locals named Randy Steidel and Herb Whitlock. On the way home, Harrington passed out in the back of Steidel's car and was later awoken by the sound of screams coming from the Rhodes house. Harrington, who spoke through an artificial larynx, described what happened next. Harrington said he was startled and entered the Rhodes home to find Steidel coming down the stairs.
What happened after you got in the house?
Randy, Tom, and dumped me back down.
Daryl, did you notice anything different about Randy right now at this point?
He had blood on him.
Did he have anything with him?
He had a knife.
Despite Harrington's shocking story, police had a problem.
When Daryl Harrington came forward and told his story, there wasn't enough probable cause to arrest Randy or Herb because they didn't feel confident that they could convict based on a guy like Daryl Harrington.
But 2 months later, another witness came forward. Deborah Reinbolt, a local nursing aide, would confess that she'd helped Steidel and Whitlock stab the newlywed couple.
Okay, tell me what you saw happening.
Blood everywhere.
Where's Herb and where's Randy?
One was on the right side of the bed and one was by the door.
When you walked into the bedroom, what was Karen Rhodes doing?
She was yelling, "Oh my God, oh my God."
Reinbolt also gave police the murder weapon, a 5-inch knife, and agreed to testify in exchange for leniency. Police now had enough to arrest Steidl and Whitlock.
Well, I think the brutal nature of the slayings, the fact that it is a double homicide, the other aggravating factors that our office will likely seek the death penalty.
Both Herb Whitlock, age 41, and Randy Steidl, age 35, had histories of petty crime. News of their arrest reached Steidl's brother, Rory, an Illinois state trooper.
Randy, he drank, being a bar setting, and if he got angry or someone started something, there was a crowd, and consequently there'd be problems. A master sergeant called me and said, "Your brother's been arrested for double murder." In my mind, the Illinois State Police were involved in the investigation. Number one, well, he's got to be guilty. Number two, he's going to face the death penalty. And number three, a jury in East Central Illinois, they're going to give him the death penalty.
That night, Rory Steidl met with investigators.
They said that if you'll get him to confess, we'll spare him the death penalty, otherwise he's getting the death penalty. I marched right up to the jail, asked to talk to Randy.
I'm pacing back and forth in his holding cell. He came up to me and he goes, "I've talked to the prosecutor, I've talked to Jack Eckerty."
I said, "You know, if they come up with hair, fiber, any type of trace evidence, they're gonna get you. You're gonna get the death penalty. So, if you did it, you need to let me know now."
He slammed that stool down and screamed back at me, "They don't arrest people that aren't guilty." You know, and I just, that's my little brother telling me that. I should just confess, cooperate, and they won't seek the death penalty?
I was thinking, my God, we're talking about your life. I don't want you to die. I went up there to try to save my brother's life.
Randy Steidl went on trial for the murders of Dyke and Karen Rhodes in 1987.
The prosecution's case was that Randy and Herbie were dealing drugs to Dyke Rhodes, and that Dyke owed Herbie money for a drug debt that he hadn't paid.
Prosecutors focused special attention on the testimony of eyewitnesses Daryl Harrington.
He knew certain things, at least in our minds, were not things the town drunk would know.
And Debbie Reinbolt, who described seeing Randy and Herb stab the Rhodes to death. Reinbolt also described a broken lamp she saw in the Rhodes bedroom.
The prosecutor, in his closing argument, made repeated references to the lamp to bolster the credibility of Deborah Reinbolt.
Debbie Reinbolt's testimony was a little bit of a revelation. She was vivid, she was convincing, and you've got to remember, in Champaign County, I'm coming from having prostitutes, drug addicts testify as witnesses on behalf of the state. Those are the people that are present when homicides occur.
After a one-week trial, Randy's jury was out for just 6.5 hours.
I sat down next to my attorney, and judge ordered the jury to be brought in, and I don't see their faces because they're all looking at the tops of their shoes. And I know it's not going to be good. Your stomach and your heart's in your throat because I'm listening for two words: not guilty. And I only hear one word. It doesn't sink in until I hear my mother wailing behind me. I never will forget that. And I realized just then, they just convicted me of double murder I had nothing to do with. And I'm telling you, it is like somebody just reached over and turned the light switch off on your life.
Though Herb Whitlock was convicted of only one of the murders and sentenced to life in prison, Randy was found guilty of killing both Dyke and Karen and sentenced to death. In 1987, Randy Steidl was sent to death row for the murders of Dyke and Karen Rhodes. While preparing Randy's appeals, the defense hired investigator Bill Clutter to help with the case.
You know, the first time I met Randy, he was going into what they called the condemned unit and having a prisoner who's shackled and brought in front of you. I mean, the reality of that really hits you.
You know, I was pretty distraught, angry at the system. My hopes were dashed.
Attorney Mike Metnick, a death penalty specialist, handled Randy's appeals.
Randy was assigned an execution date, but it's an incredibly long process to get from point A to point B.
Mike Metnick and Bill Clutter come to see me, laid out the case, told me it's going to be an uphill battle. But they believe in me.
In the year 2000, the Illinois State Police, who investigated the Rhodes murders, promoted veteran officer Michael Callahan to commander of investigations. It was his dream job.
Police officers or their integrity or what they did was just never questioned. Whatever they said or they did, you believed it as the truth.
I think that Mike, as a person, his set of morals and standards are so high. His sense of right and wrong has never faltered.
Callahan's first assignment was to review the Rhodes murder case.
I got a call from the patrol lieutenant, and he advised me that I was going to be getting a case to review. There was going to be a 48-hour show on that case, and the command was a little bit concerned.
Reviewing a closed case was unusual, but his bosses at the Illinois State Police worried that newly focused media attention might cause problems.
My initial thought was, well, of course we got the right guys. The Illinois State Police, we don't make mistakes. We wouldn't put innocent men in prison. But I'll never forget the day that I walked in. I looked at the file sitting there, and I had not even turned the first page when I got a phone call from Sergeant Jack Eckerty, who was the case agent in the Rhodes homicide. And he blurted out, please don't ruin my reputation. I'm not a dirty cop. So it was a definite red flag to me.
Callahan began by going through the prosecution's timeline of events, starting with Darrell Harrington's drinking with Steidel and Whitlock.
Later on that evening, what happened?
I had drank the other day. Can you take me home?
Randy and Herbie, in Randy's vehicle, drove to Dyke and Karen Rhodes' house the night of the murder, brought Darrell Harrington with him, and asked him to wait in the car.
As Harrington stayed in the car, Steidel and Whitlock went to the front door to confront Dyke Rhodes.
Darrell Harrington said he heard them arguing about money. When they argued, they could get very heated.
Harrington later heard screams. Inside, he discovered the crime scene.
What happened when you went in the bedroom, Darrell?
It was a body laying there. And then other half, I seen a body on the bed, a female.
Darrell encountered Randy and Herbie, bloody, and was told, you didn't see this, or the same thing will happen to you.
And I run like hell after that.
But police reports showed Debbie Reinbolt also claimed to have been with Steidel and Whitlock that night.
Deborah Rembold comes forward with a story that says, well, I was with Herb and Randy that night, and they invited me to come along with them to the Rhodes house.
What position was Karen Rhodes in? I mean, was she trying to leave and you caught her?
No, I didn't caught her.
So she was just lying there watching Steidel and Whitlock stab her husband. And is that what happened?
Yes.
Okay.
The stories from the key witnesses left Callahan with a glaring question.
They've made this case based on these two eyewitnesses, but the eyewitnesses contradict each other.
Darrell Harrington was supposed to have been at the same scene, and her story doesn't include him, and his story doesn't include her.
They never saw each other, never knew one or another was there. That was a problem for me as a police officer.
But this discrepancy didn't seem to bother lead prosecutor Mike McFatridge or assistant state's attorney Mike Zoff.
Reinbolt's presentation was consistent with the physical evidence that I had. For example, she talked about a broken lamp. One of the firefighters, he found the same thing. From my view, that was what we call corroboration.
But Callahan was about to discover evidence that would call into question both the lamp and the murder weapon Debbie Reinbold had given police. Concerns were mounting for Lieutenant Michael Callahan as he reinvestigated the Rhodes murders.
When you have witnesses that have questionable histories, it's doubly important to corroborate everything that they say.
Deborah Reinbold, in her story, talks about seeing a broken lamp and seeing one of the men holding up a piece of this broken lamp during the murders.
The crime scene photos of the lamp raised questions for defense investigator Bill Clutter.
You can actually see on the carpet where the fireman had removed the lamp that there was a silhouette of an intact lamp. What the lamp did is it protected that area of carpet. We were able to prove forensically that that lamp had to have been broken by firefighters as they entered the room and after they suppressed the fire, not during the murders.
That meant Debbie Reinbold's testimony about the lamp had been false. Even more troubling were facts Callahan learned about the purported murder weapon.
The knife that Deborah Reinbold presented was a folding knife. It's called a ricasso, where the knife bends over. That knife had a blade of 5 and some inches long.
One of the things the pathologist did was measure the depth of the wounds. On both bodies, the wounds were more than 6 inches deep. We then took it to Michael Bodden, a forensic pathologist, and he provided us an affidavit and analysis.
What board certifications do you have?
Three areas of pathology: anatomic pathology, clinical pathology, forensic pathology.
I think Dr. Michael Bodden was able to refute the knife very easily. It was a 5-inch blade. The deepest wounds were 6 3/8 inches. There was a hilt on the knife. There would have been hilt marks for it to go as deep as 6 3/8 inches. I felt like, wow, I have this evidence that these two men are innocent. They're going to finally be freed. We're going to be able to actually conduct an investigation and try and find out who the real killers are.
Randy's incarceration had torn his family apart. Randy's brother, State Trooper Rory Steidel, believed Randy was guilty. Randy's mother wanted to see for herself, so she visited him behind bars.
Now you see your mother's eyes, tears streaming down her cheeks, sets down. She said, "You look at me right now. Did you have anything to do with this at all?" I looked her right in her eyes, and I said, "Mom, I've done some bad things in my life, but I've never done anything like this. You know I'm not capable of doing anything like this." As soon as I got that out of my mouth, she was up and out of that visiting booth, slammed the door.
And when we left, she said, "He didn't do that, Rory." I said, "Well, how do you know?" And she said, "By the way he answered my question. I looked him right in the eye. I know when he's lying to me."
Despite their mother's belief in Randy's innocence, only hard evidence could shake Rory's faith in the system. That evidence was about to come from an unlikely source.
My epiphany came when I got the call from Randy's attorney that said, "I just received a letter from Debbie Reinbold that says your brother wasn't there and that he had nothing to do with it and that she's willing to speak to me."
Do you swear that the testimony you're about to give truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Christine.
Thank you. Ms. Reinbold, my name is Michael Metnick, and I am the attorney for Randy Steidel. Do you understand that?
Yes, I do.
Okay, why is it that you're here today?
Because there were some things that didn't work truthful in the testimonies. And
were you there at the Rhodes' house the night they were killed?
Nope.
That's when I was done with the state's case. She was either there or she wasn't. Who's she lying to? Either way, she's not credible.
Why did you mention Randy Steidel's name?
Why did I?
Yes.
At that point, you mean?
Yes.
Because that's who everybody was saying did it.
Okay.
Around the time of Reinbold's recantation, Bill Clutter obtained a previously unknown box of records from the Paris Police Department.
We were able to go through and view all of the police reports that included polygraph reports that had never been disclosed to us. a polygraph report where Daryl Harrington had failed the polygraph.
But if Reinbolt and Harrington were lying, why had both of them fingered Steidl and Whitlock for the crime? Randy thought he knew.
2 weeks before Dyke and Karen Rhodes were murdered, Herb Whitlock and myself had went to the FBI about prosecutor Mike McFatridge.
Randy and Herb believe state's attorney Mike McFatridge was unfairly targeting them for drug deals they had nothing to do with.
And they provided information about the state's attorney, and the allegation they made to the FBI was that he was protecting drug dealers and gambling in Paris, Illinois.
It was common knowledge to see the prosecutor out in bars every night, loaded. But yet the next morning, he's in court prosecuting somebody for the same offense. That's what alerted me to the fact that he would do anything he could, you know, to frame it for the Rhodes murder.
For Callahan, this upped the stakes.
My question was, would a state's attorney try to railroad and frame two men that were willing to go to the FBI and maybe have him arrested for his own illegal doings?
Callahan also learned disturbing information about one of the lead detectives in the case, Jim Parrish, who had secured Debbie Reinbolt's testimony.
There was instances where both Harrington and Reinbolt will talk about how police induced them with alcohol. Never in my life as a Illinois State Police officer have I ever seen such blatant disregard for policy and procedure. I mean, you would be destroying your case.
They did in fact take Daryl to Jimmy's cabin south of Paris and did question him and did buy alcohol for him. And what kind of mental condition and physical condition are they in if they don't have alcohol and you have them at a secluded location? What are they going to tell you to get that drink?
I wanted to open an investigation centering on Jim Parrish and Jack Eckerty and Mike McFatridge, looking at them for official misconduct, suborning perjury, and impeding a criminal investigation, and worse.
But Mike Callahan was about to discover the consequences of turning the spotlight on his own department. Michael Callahan now knew the case against Randy Steidl was deeply flawed and needed to be reinvestigated. In the year 2000, he took his findings to his superiors.
We went into Lieutenant Colonel Carper's office, very plush. She closes the door and she's in uniform. She sits down behind her desk.
Callahan walked Carper through the flawed evidence, the conflicting testimonies, and the recantations. He even highlighted reports that Detectives Parrish and Eckerty had plied witnesses Reinbolt and Harrington with alcohol to shape their testimony.
She looks at us and she said, "You cannot reopen the Rhodes case. It's too politically sensitive." I flash back to all the days I went undercover and risked my life, always believing in the Illinois State Police and that we would always do the right thing no matter what. And then you're told that a murder is too politically sensitive, especially a murder where you've just said there's innocent men in prison because of it. The real killers are out there, and there was misconduct by our own. You're ignoring this?
Callahan refused to comply with Carper's orders and continued working on the case.
Those two guys were innocent. I had to keep going.
He soon discovered a number of leads in the case that were never followed.
There were any number of suspects. It was like, you know, Murder on the Orient Express or something.
When I reviewed the case, there were several other suspects that, for whatever reasons, the original investigators didn't follow those leads. One of the suspects in the case, Bill Stark, he was a banker by day. There was rumors that he was a peeping Tom that was seen in the Rhodes neighborhood that time. It was never really investigated by the police. He would tell both his wife and family members that he remembered seeing a knife going up and down, and he believed that he was the one that killed Dyke and Karen Rhodes.
6 months before Randy's trial, Phil Stark was found dead of an alleged suicide.
Of course, none of those reports made it into the discovery before Randy's trial. And the interesting thing about Phil Stark's suicide, Phil Stark, when he allegedly committed suicide, was shot once in the head and once in the heart. I suppose it's possible to make those shots simultaneous, but to me, that raises some red flags.
While Mike McFatridge had cited Dyke Rhodes' possible involvement with drugs as a motive for the murders, Callahan found files in the case pointing to Karen Rhodes as the main target.
There was one initial report that talked about how Karen Rhodes said she had seen her boss, Bob Morgan, loading machine guns and large amounts of cash in his Corvette and was heading to Chicago.
Bob Morgan was one of the most powerful men in Paris, and Karen didn't want to cross him. According to her mother, she was considering quitting her job, but just a few weeks later, she was murdered.
I started looking at that case and saying, wow, this was definitely a motive. They did talk to Bob Morgan, and he gave them a statement that he felt that probably some bikers got drunk and went back to rape Karen Rhodes, and things got out of hand, and she was killed.
Bob Morgan denied any involvement in the murders and passed a polygraph test. But Callahan wondered if investigators had turned their gaze away from the influential businessman for fear of political payback.
One of the very first suspects that police also looked at was a drifter put up at the Hotel France, downtown, four blocks from the crime scene. According to the radio dispatch logs, he was the very first suspect after they discovered the bodies. Around 9 a.m. in the morning, Jack Eckerty of the Illinois State Police goes to the Hotel France. And by that time, he'd already checked out and was long gone.
Clutter believed that drifter was none other than Tommy Lynn Sells, one of the most notorious serial killers in the country.
I like to use a knife. A gun is too violent, too noisy. And I like to watch the eyes fade, the pupil fade. It's just like setting their soul free.
I get this letter from Tommy Lynn Sells after I interview him. In the letter, he makes this cryptic remark about the Eiffel Tower ever been. It's nice this time of year. And of course, you know, it's a reference to Paris, Illinois. I'm convinced that Sells committed the murder.
Tommy Lynn Sells was executed in Texas in April 2014.
You had all these different characters who you could weave a possible narratives, and I don't see any way that any of these stories hung together. We don't know who killed these guys.
By now, Randy Steidel had spent nearly 12 years on death row and lost all his appeals. And he was about to come face to face with his final chance at freedom. Randy Steidel had spent almost 12 years on death row while his attorney, Michael Metnick, filed appeals in his case. One of Metnick's main arguments was that Randy's original trial attorney had been ineffective.
I could best describe John Mueller as being a real estate attorney on Monday, a car accident attorney on Tuesday, and on Friday, a criminal defense attorney. He was ineptly unqualified. He ignored the case.
As close to zero as there is. That was the amount of work that went into the fact investigation for Randy Steidel's case.
I would challenge him when the witnesses were taking a stand against me that you need to talk to so-and-so to impeach them. That's a lie. And he patted me on the back and said, don't you know what my job is? And I said, yeah, prove my innocence. No, my job is to create a reasonable doubt. Once he said that, before I was convicted, I realized, I'm done.
That's why the trials I mentioned.
Well, there's not much to say. The jury ruled against us. I didn't think they would. That's that. Tomorrow morning we have a hearing on the death
sentence. In 1999, after years of appeals in the Illinois courts, Metnick finally had a breakthrough in Randy's case. While the judge did not give Randy a new trial, he agreed that Randy's attorneys had been ineffective during sentencing and changed Randy's sentence from death to life in prison.
Luckily, I got life without parole. Many attorneys have told me it's far easier to get a new trial when you're doing life than it is on death row and have lost all your appeals.
Michael Callahan had looked into Randy's case and found serious misconduct within the Illinois State Police. But before defying his boss by releasing the results of his investigation, Callahan needed to tell his wife, Lily.
when he got this case, he started coming home and doing unusual things, waking up in the middle of the night. He would bring flowcharts, put them down our hallway, and connect the dots for me. I told Mike, I think that if you're quiet and if you're not fighting back and not trying to reveal the truth and not speak out, then you're a part of the problem.
Callahan decided to defy Colonel Carper. He sent his findings to Illinois Attorney General Jim Ryan. But Jim Ryan declined to review Callahan's report because he'd been accepting campaign money from Bob Morgan, Karen Rhodes' former boss, and a suspect in the case. Mike Callahan was soon transferred back to patrol, a humiliation for someone who had been a commander of investigations.
He goes, I guess I just tried to tell the truth. And he said, Diane Carper removed me from this case. That was a hard time. That was it was one of those fight or flight things where we just had to fight.
By 2001, the Illinois courts had repeatedly declined to give Randy a new trial. Randy's last chance at freedom would now come at the federal level.
It is the court of last resort. After 15 years of state court findings, most federal judges assume that those state court findings are correct.
Judge Mike McCuskey would oversee the case. A veteran of the bench, McCuskey had never granted a petition for a new trial.
You think year after year, is somebody going to come with a case that you can look at and say, this case was decided wrongly? You always wonder if 100% of all of your cases are going one way, are you looking at them correctly?
Fortunately, Randy got the fresh eyes of a federal judge that was not connected to the prosecution in Paris, Illinois, was not beholden to the cops in Paris.
You've got witnesses that supposedly came off the street and are up watching a horrible murder, and they don't see each other. That is just unheard of.
You have a federal judge that's saying that there was evidence favorable to Randy Steidel's case that was never disclosed by the prosecution. These are the same things I'd been telling the state police for 3 years now.
On June 17th, 2003, I entered the following order. Petitioner's conviction is hereby vacated. The state shall have 120 days from the date of this order to release or retry Randy Steidel.
When Judge McCuskey granted me a new trial, I was still holding my breath because I'd watched guys on death row get a new trial and have the attorney general appeal it, have it taken away, and within 60 days, they're strapped to a gurney being executed.
One thing I could state with a degree of confidence in this business, there is no certainty, no certainty at all.
Randy's fate would now rest in the hands of Illinois' new attorney general, Lisa Madigan, who would decide to release Randy or try him again. Michael Callahan knew he'd have to get his findings to Madigan now or live forever with the knowledge that he'd failed to help set an innocent man free. The state of Illinois was facing an ultimatum in the Randy Steidel case. Retry Randy for the Rhodes murders or set him free. Michael Callahan now had a small window to deliver what he'd discovered about the case. One day, he got a call from the deputy attorney general.
I went over everything in the case, my concerns of misconduct, the fact that the two eyewitnesses had no credibility, how detectives had actually distorted and lied in reports, witnesses that were ignored.
But Mike McFatridge, who prosecuted Randy Steidel, felt the jury got it right the first time.
Ever since the Attorney General Lisa Madigan came in charge of the appeal, the case has been mismanaged either through indifference or incompetence. That they were clearly capable of committing murder, and that was proven.
The prosecutors, to the bitter end, always maintain that the person is guilty, because otherwise it's to admit that they and the police that work with them fabricated evidence.
In the end, based on Callahan's report and a lack of faith in the evidence, Attorney General Lisa Madigan decided that Judge McCuskey's ruling was the correct one.
That
It's been 17 years, 3 months, 1 week, and 2 days. And I'm ready for it to end.
We weren't going to believe that Randy was going to be freed until he actually walked through the doors.
And it was a perfect day. You know, sun was out, not a cloud in the sky. They usher us all in. We have an opportunity to get Randy, you know, psychologically prepared for the moment when he's going to step out.
You ready to go?
Walking behind this, you know, parade of heroes who made this happen. Good. You know, just like passing by the walls and thinking, yeah, damn, this is really happening.
You ready?
Let's go.
Let's go for the one.
It's a flood of emotions. And my mom held up real good. Everybody did.
You know, that day was very, very special.
In 2005, Randy filed a civil suit against the state of Illinois for wrongful imprisonment. While he was in the courthouse, he and Mike Metnick paid a visit to the courtroom of Judge McCuskey.
And he saw us in the gallery.
I look at him and I mouth these words, "Is that Randy Steidel?" And he nods his head, "Yes." I recess the court. As I'm saying this right now, I'm even getting goosebumps.
Then McCuskey signaled us to come back in chambers.
There's a split second where you just hug. I didn't cry. I came close.
You know, I'm starting to get emotional.
I knew how difficult it was to get to that point, to have a judge overturn 15 years of state court findings. It's almost unheard of, and I was trying to think of something to say to the man, but the only thing I could think of, I just shook his hand and I said, "Thank you for giving me my life back."
We make decisions every day, but we don't save lives. Police do, firemen do, heroes. But that day I knew I'd saved his life.
Mike Callahan's fight to bring out the truth about corruption and misconduct in Randy's case had ruined his career. In 2003, he sued the state of Illinois for violating his right to free speech.
I was angry. I felt betrayed by my department. The only thing I'm guilty of is wanting to solve a homicide, look for the truth.
Callahan won his lawsuit, but before he could collect his award, the Supreme Court declared that government employees didn't have free speech protection if they were talking about something that involved their work. It was a huge setback for whistleblowers.
The ruling basically tells police officers, why risk being fired? Why risk all the turmoil? Just turn your back to it, as long as you're not the one doing it.
In 2008, Mike Callahan's $700,000 award was officially overturned.
Knowing that I'm free to walk out that door anywhere I want to go, that gave me a lot of peace.
I think it's supposed to be 80 today.
Randy puts a lot of value on our family and on family relationships, and I'm glad that he's able to enjoy his life now and that I'm a part of it.
The reason I'm here today are the people that would stand up and risk everything, everything they worked for, because of what's right. I'm extremely lucky. Justice is what the Rhodes family should have. They're the ones that deserve some justice.
Fellow citizens, we cannot escape history. Today, in this room, by a constitutional majority of the members elected to the Illinois General Assembly, and by my actions as governor, we have abolished the death penalty in Illinois, the land of Lincoln. This is the most difficult decision that I've made as governor. It was made after many days and nights of reflection and review.